Good morning, everybody. This is a presentation on the seed scale methodology. It's a Carl Taylor Memorial Session, number two, and in honor of Carl Taylor, who passed away this year. Today we're going to be talking about three aspects, well, all aspects of the seed scale methodology. The first presentation is going to be on how the seed scale methodology works. I mean, what is the theory, mainly, will be what is the theory of seed scale methodology? And then we have two practical presentations on how the seed scale methodology has been put into practice in both China and in Peru. The seed scale methodology, as many of you know, is a strategy for community change that was identified on the basis of worldwide study of successes in equitable and sustainable community change. Through identification and analysis of successful experiences, Carl and his son Daniel Taylor conducted a study with support from UNICEF and also with support from Rockefeller Foundation, and the ongoing findings and conclusions were discussed with international experts brought together periodically to discuss the ongoing findings. This was in the early 90s. And further development of the methodology has been through practical field experiences. The methodology itself is based on field experience. It's very practically based methodology. The methodology, as will be presented, has that you should be looking for are basically four principles, five criteria, and seven annual steps. So it's very simplified down to core elements, and this also three levels of scale. So these simple steps, criteria, principles, and levels of scale will be discussed in this presentation as a guide to how to sustainably initiate development in a community and then scale up those successes. We've modified the presentation slightly so that the first presentation will be given by Henry Gordon Taylor, who is the son of Carl Taylor, so it's most appropriate that he be making this presentation. Dr. Taylor is currently a faculty at the Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health and Health Policy and Management. He also teaches interns and residents in primary care and internal medicine. And at the same time, he's serving as deputy director of or deputy health officer of Cecil County Health Department in Maryland. So the way he sees it, he is working at all different levels with the community, with change agents, and with the government in the same way that you will be seeing as what is proposed by the seed scale methodology. Dr. Taylor was previously health director of the state of West Virginia for many years. He has an MD degree from Harvard, a specialty in internal medicine, and received his Master of Public Health from Johns Hopkins University. So, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you, Laura. That was wonderful, and it's really great to be here. And I know many of you have heard bits and pieces about seed scale. Some folks view it as a mantra, and other people look at it as a philosophy, and a lot of people look at it and say, this is common sense, and all of those are true. So the important thing and the main point I'd like to make in this presentation is we're trying to summarize the intersection of a lot of different theories, and most importantly, I used to remind Dad that I think it was Gilbert Ryle says, but the whole notion of practice and experience, and it isn't Gilbert Ryle, but the quote that we talk about is normally you say, you know, it works in theory, let's see if it works in practice. Well, this methodology grew up out of practice, so we know it works in practice, but at the end of my presentation, I want you to evaluate whether it works in theory. As Laura talked about, there was, Dad obviously had many years of experience in 70 different countries and a vast network of people and connections having grown up, and that's a whole separate story. But he and Daniel, after Dad had retired, were really looking at questions of development. Daniel's background is in education, and his doctoral dissertation was specifically about how do you convey values? How do you educate for values and helping people achieve a certain outlook on life? And so I think Daniel did it more as a way that he could go out hiking with Dad and going out to exotic places. But the two of them worked with Dad's dear friend Jim Grant and put together the expert committee that resulted in what we call the Green Book, with a number of case studies in 92, and that was the task force. They reviewed the findings, they had many exciting discussions, presented their monograph in 1995 at Copenhagen of the case studies, and then proceeded to write up the book, Just and Lasting Change, which was basically the culmination of all of that work. The next book is already been accepted at Oxford University Press and will be coming out in 2011, and they're very excited about it. Rather than do a second edition of Just and Lasting Change, which really stands on its own with its classic case studies, they've really explored many of the concepts that I'm going briefly review today. It's in purple there, which is, there is a website that is seed-scale.org. It's currently under development. It may actually go live. I was just checking my email beforehand, and it's due to go live in the next several days. This is a website that has essentially the same conceptual basis of what's going to be presented in this talk today, but more importantly, it is an interactive Moodle educational tool. People will be asked to sort of sign up and register, and it actually will be essentially a short course, but not a short course for academics, a short course for communities, for governments, for people who just want an overview, and then as they get intrigued in different aspects, they'll be able to drill off into various tangents. The modules are being designed to be very short and interactive, and over time we hope that the site grows to convey everybody's experience and can potentially expand to include case studies. So the way Daniel and Dad have been explaining this in Seed Scale is as a sort of a philosophy, is it's capturing that human energy, the power of people connections, the relationships. It's the energy that happens in a relationship between two people. And when you think about your own life, we always just sort of stand a little taller when we think about our successes, and that's true of the community also. So how do we identify that what is working in a community? How do we then help that community share it with others and learn from others? And then how do we really spread the word and sustain that and structure it so that seed can grow to scale and has those benefits there? Each community starts off very differently. And so this is a list. If anybody came in late, there are copies of this PowerPoint in the back, so I will err on the side of talking less and letting, you know, respecting your ability to read. And one of the key concepts is that the action that takes place, whether it's by government, whether it's by outsiders coming in, whatever action happens, it must be focused first on helping the community use the resources it already has available, and then helping it grow those resources. If you think, using this metaphor of human energy, in human energy, it really isn't a fixed pie. If you look at your own life, there are those times when you get impassioned about something, and The energy keeps on flowing if you really hit the potential source of that energy. So you don't really have haves and have-nots. We find that it happens, the people who are very rich can get energized. It's a little harder sometimes to get them energized. Especially people out in resource-poor communities, because of the innovation and creativity, will get enthusiastic about taking action and figuring out their own problems. Necessity is the mother of invention, and there is, I think, a lot of groundbreaking psychology work that could be done to really tap into how people in relationship generate very positive action. And then once you've got that first spark, just like starting a fire, you put on little pieces of wood. You don't throw all the wood on at the same time, but you put little bits of fuel and help that spark grow into something that can be sustained. Once you've got a good fire, a lot of energy going, you can make things happen. So that's sort of this grand vision philosophy, okay? Now let's get realistic. Because you can't do development. And I actually, it's not that Daniel and Dad are opposed to this. They just have experienced and have spent their lives working in traditional development where you need resources. The text's a little small, but the money, minerals, natural energy, production, all that. You need societal structures, and that list there is very important. You also have to really develop the society as a whole, and more and more we're finding that integrated approach. Any of the projects dealing with the Millennium Development Goals are recognizing that they are not achieving results by technical means alone. They're also not achieving results by behavioral means, but they do achieve results when they create the fundamental relationships that power social development. And so you have to figure out, how do you balance those relationships? How do you bring people together in community? How do you bring people together to work together? How in your own lives, in your own work, whatever it is, how do you get things done? You do it with people. You aren't bossing them around all the time. You're engaging with them, and there's a trust that's built up. So it's not that traditional development is wrong, but rather that we may have been misattributing the success that we see to the wrong factors. If we're only measuring technical interventions and ignoring behavioral change or the relationships that are produced, we'll attribute our success entirely to the technical interventions. So how do we then go ahead and grow that human energy? And I'll let you read this. And you can invoke the Margaret Mead quote and all that about changing the world. But you also identify what is it that each of us contributes to the larger goal. How do we work as a team? And you can bring in all of your theory about management and high performance teaming with the second bullet. What Daniel and Dad have done in the seed scale methodology, and those of us who have been trying to apply it in our own lives, is think about, okay, how do you get started? Dad spent many years, he wrote his paper on surveillance for equity in the 70s, I think. It was probably out when you were doing your MPH, but he had written about the whole notion of surveillance for equity, and so we know that it's out there, we know that it happens, but when he then spent 20-some years trying to figure out how do you measure equity, how do you measure empowerment? And he would rhetorically get people thinking, he had a lot of ideas and we've tried some of them, but he would rhetorically try and get people engaged on how do you do it by saying, well, you can't measure empowerment, you only know it when you see it. His teaching point there was, when you see somebody empowered, when you see a community that's empowered, you know it when you see it. But he was trying to get you to reflect on, what is it that you're seeing? Are you noticing the right factors? And from that, they've distilled these four core principles that seem to be the way in which you can dissect. You know it when you see it, but how do you take it apart? What lenses do you put on to really see it? You need to have all four. Getting each one right is going to take practice and experimentation. It's very easy to, I mean, a three-ring circus is bad enough, but a four-ring circus is a whole other thing. So it is not easy. And this is an interesting oxymoron, I think, by saying that traditional development moves more slowly than seed scale and costs more money. In the short run, it seems as though a magic bullet approach is going to give people who are in the planning offices writing it out on paper, it seems as though that's what's going to work. But in practice, it's not going to get you to where you need to be. It is not going to be self-correcting. It is not going to be an adaptive learning process. And we know from Senge and all sorts of other theory, you've got to modify. You've got to improvise. But you have to do it with an open mind. You have to be systematic. So we can build the ship while we're sailing it if we're staying afloat and if we have some sort of plan. Principle one, build from success. What is working, and strengthen that. There are two things about this, and Gretchen Bergman talks about positive deviance. If you focus first on success, two things. One is people like to talk about their successes, so it's a lot easier to get people to talk about what's working than what's not. The second is there are a lot more things that are not working than what are working. So if you build from success, you've automatically made your job easier. People want to talk about it, and there are not that many successes, but the ones you find, you can really reinforce. What you find, and this goes throughout psychology as well as any sort of management theory, one success builds success, and you start getting momentum. Being the younger brother, I have to take pot shots at my older brother, and Daniel's gotten a little bit far off on the physics of all this, so he gets into energy and momentum and but that's okay. It's how he understands it. What counts is, and what is implicit in the whole seed scale process, is that you internalize it and reframe it for your own situation and your own way of thinking about it. But you will find that if you deviate from the building from success in whatever thought pattern you have, it won't work. Principle two is the three-way partnership, which is a lot easier to talk about than it is to live. I think it was Henry Nouwen says, or Parker Palmer says that a community is a place where you can talk to your enemies. Because you have to have a community. You have to be in a relationship to deal with the really tough things that need to be dealt with. High-performance teams can raise issues and talk about them, and you can shape the supportive environment by talking to people about what's not working and what could be done, and looking at possibilities and really listening. So the fallacy in much of the traditional development thought is that we can have one magic bullet and the communities can grow on their own. Well, hello. If people had been able to do it on their own, they would have done it if it was the right thing to do. So it's not that you can just push it onto somebody and blame the victim, or it's not that there's just one thing that will help them. We know that there are multiple factors that come together, and the community needs help in sorting that out. So here's their graphic. There's the bottom-up community mobilization. There's then the top-down enabling environment. There are the outside-in ideas and mentoring. And I'm particularly fascinated as I look at Dad's life and as I become more of an experienced teacher myself. What is real mentoring? And I'm going to embarrass Archie by saying, people who want to know, Archie's the type of mentor, so here I am. Internal medicine resident, and I decided I wanted to take some pediatrics, and I'd go to Archie, and I was fresh out of Harvard, and so I'd present this case of a kid to Archie, and he'd look at me, and he'd say, Henry, does the kid look sick? That's the right question, and a mentor knows how to ask the right question concisely and get me to think, oh, wow. So what is that outside in idea and the mentorship that then sustains the forward momentum? Little cutesy, but easy to remember. And you can communicate it in many different languages. You can communicate it in your own mindsets. Principle two is something that, again, you will customize for yourself. But if you don't have a three-legged stool or a combination, and it's not the people at the corners, it's the lines and the space between that is, I think, the relational aspect. Principle three, okay, evidence-based. Well, what is evidence? A politician is much more convinced by a story coming from somebody who's a donor and a constituent than by reams of scientific data. So government, evidence is whether it worked before, it was tried by a preceding administration and it didn't work, why do we think it would work now? Evidence to government is very different from evidence to the expert. And evidence to the community is really, does it work? A farmer will adopt a new type of grain, regardless of their philosophy, if their neighbor's field gets better yield. So evidence is different to all these groups, and my particular fascination is how do we get these three knowledge systems to come together and find out how to communicate that. So what is the point here with evidence-based decisions? Success comes when decision-making uses facts gathered locally. It's got to be real. Communication theory as well as epidemiology tell you that. Here's the fallacy and the misconception. I shouldn't say fallacy, I'm sorry. Here's the misperception in traditional development methodology is that decisions are made by people in power, or people, the golden rule, whoever has the gold rules, or the strongest opinions, the person who can shout the loudest, the squeakiest wheel. Moving on, principle four, behavior change. Fundamental change happens when people will change their behavior. Now this is different from, there's the technical intervention and the behavioral aspect, there's technical aspects to the intervention and behavioral aspects to an intervention, but the behavioral aspects of an intervention are different from somebody taking action and changing their behavior. Most of directed counseling theory right now is saying that fundamentally somebody has to act differently in a relationship. That's what principle four is saying. If I start acting differently, my wife's going to start acting differently and treating me differently. If I act differently, my kids will maybe act differently. And again, we've slipped into some distorted thinking when programs only look at the measurable outputs, because we all know if you're really an honest administrator, you can play with the numbers and play with the data. So, I think I'm doing okay on time. I better wind down, I think. I'm just trying to honor the timing here. So the key concept, so that's it. You've got the four principles. You've got the vision. Now, how do you do it? Again, you need to look at a successful thing, analyze it in terms of the four principles, but this next step and the next portion of this talk is directed at what are the baby steps that you need to get there. You gotta crawl before you can walk. You gotta walk before you can run. You may see somebody running the Boston Marathon, but they didn't get there by accident. There's a lot of learning and stepwise. So the next points here about the seven tasks, and I call it sort of the, what's Christmas Carol, but anyway, the Partridge in a Pear Tree part of Seed Scale. It makes it easier to remember. But this is the steps and the tasks that people can use as a checklist. And all of the current theory about checklists and performance monitoring is very well researched. This is the checklist to be using when you think about seed scale and monitoring whether a community has it or not. You got to get people together, and they've got to be the people on the front line. Military folks know this a lot. You then identify the successes. Okay? People like to get together and start talking about and bragging. Get them bragging. But then you do what Raj and Maybell Arole did in Jump Kid. They went into a new community once, and Raj and Maybell said, okay, we want to meet with people, and they sat down. Well, they had done a little bit of homework, right? But they didn't. So Raj was sitting there having his tea, and he says, gee, that's funny. You're all men. I don't see any women here. And he kept having tea, and he said, you know, we'll start the meet. And they said, aren't you going to start? He said, no, we'll start the meeting when the women are here. And the women came. And he kept having tea, and they said, the women are here. He goes, well, but I don't see any of the Dalit, the untouchables. So somebody went out, and so you get the story. But you get your committee together. Whoops, what happened there? Identify your successes. Then you look at the successes elsewhere. That's learning. Because if you go see if you're dealing with a complex multifactorial problem, what you want to know is not what is some theory about the one magic bullet or some donor's perception about how the world ought to run. You want to go see another community and say, hey, Warren and Gretchen, how did it work in Haiti? Okay, Archie, what happened when you were doing stuff? You know, just go ask them. And particularly if the village people, the people who are on the front line, they'll ask the best questions. You then start comparing yourself, because we can't change unless we know the difference. So you get a sense of where I am right now with my local evidence. And what am I going to do about it? And particularly the local evidence and what you've learned from other people says, oh, I could do that. And that's actually, if you get a chance, read Carl's last paper, and a longer story about that. But in The Lancet is Carl's last paper and then an obituary of him, which was an intriguing thing to help write. But in the last part of his paper, it's 700 words. But it really distills a lot of his thinking here about how do you move people forward and bring all the pieces together into an action plan. We know we need action plans. Whether you use, what is it, the log charts and all the various methodologies from planners from time immemorial. Okay, the Sumerians and other folks had good work plans. Louisiana had a good work plan before Katrina. It was a fine plan. People just didn't know it. And there were politics, there were other realities, but it wasn't the plan. So once you've got the first part going and people believing in what needs to happen, then you can have a work plan people believe in, and you implement it, and you talk about it, and you say, this isn't working. I have my talk planned out. I know where I want to go, but Laura might soon kick me, you make your mid-course corrections. Those are the seven steps. It works. I personally, if you want the theory and need the citation, I like what John Cotter says at Harvard Business School. He's the guru about leading change. Not too far off of this. Then what do you do? Okay, you have this great shining star. You have your 1,000 points of light. So now what? You try and make the energy grow, get it to spread, get it to improve quality, and that happens through cybernetics, through feedback loops. So how do we give feedback in a relationship? If we want our relationship to grow with somebody who we care about, we listen, we talk. The first part in feedback is really listening. So we do that. That's what helps it grow. That's the conceptual list. And so really going to scale is a journey, and the stories that we're going to tell here are really the stories about the journeys. Because we can tell you the theory, I can sort of give a convincing speech here, but what counts is what's the journey. And in the part that I talk, using Bob Parker and Carl's lectures that they give to the case studies in primary health care course. That's, I adapted that because two of them got to telling stories and we recorded it, and it's about 4 hours in the online course of material, hearing them tell stories. It won't be 4 hours, so don't panic, but it's a journey. And the stories are their journey, and one of the pieces I left in that they actually periodically would drop out of their talks is the 65 county project, which flopped. So the notion that communities are always developing, always changing, and as it's, the objective is achieved, the action moves on. You build the ship while you're sailing. It means that you're already afloat. You're already on something, pile of wood. But you keep building it as you go forward. You keep adapting it and evolving it to whatever you're encountering. And so there are some people who say, you know, the debate, is seed scale a methodology? Is it a process? Is it a philosophy? Whatever. Put it in whatever box works for you. But the concept here is we hope by the end of today that you're really able to take it and own it yourself and use it to help you propel your own journey. But how will you know when you get there? You know, what are you using to, where are the lines on the road? What, how do you, you know, what are the indicators, the stars that you're going to use to navigate? It's not necessarily the next exit on your GPS. It's where am I going? How will I know when I get there? There are five criteria and the five perspectives. And equity is the one, not equality of distribution of resources, but equity of outcome. Are we achieving the results? And yes, it is Marxist. We will have to give more resources to some people and less resources to others. And it is, but where it goes beyond Marxism is it's not just that the poor will have to claim what they want. The rich will have to relinquish. And there are those who have actually written about the theology of relinquishment, which is what we have to do in our empowered ways. We don't need to teach cultural competence to the people like me. That doesn't mean I don't need cultural competence. I need cultural humility. The empowered need to see what needs to be done. The rich need to change their viewpoint. The other criteria is it sustained? Does it go on? Does it work long term? A holism approach. The interdependence, the relationship, the connections between people. And iteration. It's sustained not because people go out and get another grant, get other resources from the outside, but does the process itself feed on itself and sustain that energy? So that's the iteration. This slide's a little complex, so I'm going to ignore it, but this is a detailed discussion where they contrast much of traditional development theory to what they're talking about. Oh, there is an important thing there. Sorry, anyway, it's that line there between the work plan and the budget to the work plan is an interesting oxymoron. We normally go from the budget to the work plan rather than the other way around. So in some, there are about five slides here, so I'm coming to the wind up. But most people put their energy into jobs, families, societal demands. But we do have a little bit that we like to give to something else. And the more we give and share, we can avoid the tragedy of the commons. The more we see that we have a commons, and we can put our energy into that commons, the more things can go forward. And I'll continue the nepotism. Oh, when it said no financial relationships, that is absolutely true. I have a direct conflict of interest because of all the relationships, and I'm not shy about that. But my sister Betsy's a cultural anthropologist, and she and her husband Herbert have a book about place and the importance of place and democratization. But that's part of what's happening here. So you must have the principles, you must have the local work plans, and work plans can be done in various ways, whatever is appropriate. We just saw in the, the preceding session was talking about Afghanistan and what they've been able to achieve, and it's based on work plans. Then there's the concept of three functions of scale. So I've spared you that part of the theory up until now, the three levels. But that will be what our examples will talk about. And then you use and guide and direct and keep yourself on course using the five criteria. And it's not just money. Poor communities know that. Money can corrupt and subvert. It looks like it opens options, but often those options, if you click on the ad that looks appealing on the website, someone's put that ad up there for a reason. And if you start having a lot of money and tangible resources that are coming from one place to another place, the role of government is not bad. Government and that official function is to help with the accountability, holding people honest, keeping that transparency, making sure you follow the regulations. So you must have the accounting, and but when you get on the accounting, you're worrying about where the money's coming from, so that causes the subtle psychological shift in direction away from those in greatest need to those in greatest resources and power, and you're satisfying the donor, not the people. Resourcefulness causes the resources to be used more fully. Again, little brother saying big brother's getting too cute. But community is the operative level. When I'm talking to students who are totally confused about the U.S. healthcare system, and I'll join the club, I say, look, you're trying to look at it from the top down. And if you're looking at it from Health and Human Services, it's this. If you're looking at it from the insurance companies, it's that. If you're looking at it from the hospitals, it's that. I said, but there's one way that you can simplify all this complexity. Complexity is not bad. But take the perspective of a person in the community. The U.S. healthcare system made a lot more sense to me yesterday afternoon when Shoba Aroli and I were sitting in the emergency room here with one of the presenters who had got, you know, while she was in the back. I could say, oh, I can understand it now. So you have the potential for acting together. And help the groups, which we term communities, direct that potential to achieve their objectives. But you always need to consider the context. So the Institute of Medicine in 2002 has a book, a title, a really good title, Who Will Keep the Public Healthy? Not a bad question. And the notion is the context of resources and values. So keep it in the context. And this last step slide is start with the seven steps. If you need a guide, start with the seven steps. You may find when you look at them that you already are halfway there, so that moves you forward. As they grow and you build partnerships and you build the relationships, the ideas will spread and be more adapted, and work with your partners so that you can take those places that are shining examples and bring people in to learn from them. That's why Jim Cade decided fairly early on that they needed to be a training center, that people needed to come in and have a chance to talk to the community health workers. One of the people who came in and talked was National Geographic. Okay? I mean, you know, they do your PR for you. And how do people learn? And so in the original Just and Lasting Change, they have all the acronyms. So scale one is when it happens at the community level. Scale two is this learning community, Peter Senge type stuff that we're still thinking about. And scale cubed is the larger enabling environment. And that's where I'll be talking in China about not only some of the scale cubed, but how the pieces were pulled together. Whereas Laura is going to talk more about the experience in Peru and how Future Generations has applied these concepts in Peru,